Good morning. It's time for the Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour with the Herzog Law Firm.
Will you still need me? Will you still feed me when I'm 64?
And welcome and good morning. I'm Harry Miller.
Hi, Harry. I'm Dave Kubikian.
Hi, Dave. David and I are two of the lawyers. We are the attorneys in the state planning and elder law Medicaid planning section of the Herzog Law Firm. We have four conveniently located offices in Albany, Saratoga Springs, Clifton Park, and Kingston, New York. And we are here each Saturday morning, whether it snows or not, to to talk to you and hopefully get you some interesting information that will help you think about estate planning issues that you may not have thought about in the past, and maybe also entertain you a little bit. So we are, it's a slushy morning out there, isn't
very.
It? But fortunately, it didn't freeze overnight. So like the stuff just just rolls off the cars. It really does.
It's going to be a heavy snowman day.
Yeah, this is not a day.
It's a good packing snow.
It's good,
you
good
have
packing,
snowball fighting, you know, all that stuff.
Yeah, it's not a good shoveling snow.
Well, yeah, if you're out there and you say, it's a couple inches, I'm going to go out and shovel myself. Please be careful. It's going to be very, very, very heavy snow.
Yeah, instead of shoveling, just kind of do what I do and push it aside.
Yeah, push it. Is this the kind of stuff that gunks up a snowblower too?
Slush
it just kind of pours out. I mean, years ago, I lived on Route 9 in Loudonville. You know, on the main road.
Yep.
Loudonville Road over Route 9, and a very circular driveway. Of course, that's a state highway, so those huge state plows come up, and they would throw the snow like the top 6 feet of the driveway, which is also on an upward incline. That was the most challenging part.
Oh, you got to dig through it. Oh, it's terrible.
It's wet.
What a mess.
Yeah.
My neighbor and I shared a big snowblower that a client of mine gave me about a long time ago in a land far, far away. And we shared the snowblower, and it was one of those big steel things. You know, they make them anymore, and it would cut through it most of the time. Yeah,
very nice. You know, our listening swath is so large that there's some people that are probably saying that I can't believe they made such a big deal about this supposed storm, and then we have people 40 miles north that are like, that was one hell of a storm.
Yeah, and you've got people in the hill towns and the higher elevation. It was an elevation storm, and so they got a lot. The higher elevations up to a foot, and the Berkshires are really getting slammed, or have gotten slammed, like a foot and a half. So, we're not bad at all.
Yeah, we dodged a couple of bullets this winter. That big storm in Buffalo didn't really get this far east, Oh, I was in North Carolina when that storm hit. So I didn't
conveniently.
We're Buffalo. It's a sentence you say all the time.
I was in North Carolina on Thanksgiving Day. It was 75 degrees, and I was driving around with the top down in my convertible. Eat your heart out.
No, we're all so happy for you, Harry. It's wonderful, really. So let's get into some estate planning for a moment, Harry. I know you have the numbers available. Jamie and I talked about them. I feel like it was the movie The Jerk with Steve Martin. The new phone book's here. The new phone book's here. The numbers came out, right? And thankfully, all of a sudden, you could have a lot more in your pocket, a lot more coming in every month to still qualify for Medicaid. It's amazing.
Yeah. The numbers came out, and this is a result of last year's budget, There was a lot of pressure on the governor and legislature to revise the income limits for Medicaid eligibility, which are really pretty low when you think about it, and also the asset level. Now, comparatively, the asset level currently for Medicaid eligibility in New York, the asset level currently is $16,800, which, if you look at states nationwide, isn't a bad number. Some states allow you only to have $2,000, which is the SSI limit. Or some number between that and 16,000. The income level currently for a single person, somebody who's widowed or single, is like $945, all right?
And that's for home care.
For home care, yeah. Well, if you're a person in a nursing home and you're applying for Medicaid, guess what? Your income limit is a whopping $50 a month, all right?
It's the rumored cost of a haircut these days. I don't know what haircuts cost, Harry.
Well, last time I've been going to this for probably 40 years. I pay $38 to get my hair cut. David,
I'm just counting all the money I save from not needing these haircuts.
You know, and I go like every 5 weeks, so that's 40, you know, 40.
That is what I pay too, Harry. You're right.
I'm telling you.
We should all be Dave.
Think of all the money you're saving.
We're not on TV. People don't know what Dave looks like.
There's a better option out there, gentlemen.
The razor.
You plug it in. Takes about 5 minutes.
The thing about radio, nobody sees what you're wearing on Saturday morning.
We're all a lot taller on radio as well.
So what's happening, January 1st, which is only a couple of weeks away, on January 1st, the income and asset limits in New York are dramatically increasing. So starting on January 1st, the income level for a single person receiving home care is going to go up from $900 in a month to $1,563 a month.
It's amazing.
That is, it's almost twice as much, not quite, but... Yeah,
$600.
So what it means is anyone whose income level from Social Security and pension is below $1,600 is going to be eligible for Medicaid without having to do a spend down or enroll in a pooled supplemental needs trust to cover the spend down and make it available. And those of you out there who pay medical insurance premiums, you can add your medical insurance premiums to that $1,563. So you're paying, what, $148 for your Medicare Part B coverage. And if you have supplemental insurance, you know, through some other company or through some other, you know, Part C Medicare Advantage plan, you can add that and your spouse, you know, to those numbers, which might bring you up to close to $2,000. Who knows? Depends what they are. Yeah.
The key, Harry, is that there aren't more people now eligible for Medicaid because of this income change. You are already eligible. It was just the level of spend down and how you deal with the spend down.
Right.
So the more income they allow you to have, the less circumstances we will need a spend down or a pooled trust.
Or a pooled supplemental needs trust, which, you know, those are great trusts. You can shelter your excess income in a pooled supplemental needs trust, but mechanically they're somewhat cumbersome.
Yeah.
You know, you have to tell them what bills are being paid. You have to send them a check every month for your spend down. And then you have to set up some kind of payment schedule for if you have rent or you have a mortgage or you have, whatever, your utility bills, your property taxes and things, insurance. They could be paid through that plan. But there is some effort here. So a fair number of people now will be able to avoid that.
Right. And Harry, let me just give you this real, we see this example all the time. So dad's living alone. He's getting up there. He needs home care. He gets Social Security. He's not a Rockefeller. He's getting $1,400 a month of Social Security, right? He spends every dollar of it because his house and his taxes, his insurance, food, clothing, the whole thing, right?
Right.
So previously, if we applied today for him or a year ago, right, whatever, we're going to get him qualified, but he's going to have no choice but to do this pool trust to protect that $400 or $500 he was otherwise going to spend down. Mm-hmm. For him, it's vital. Like, the plan doesn't work. He may get all the care in the world, but not be able to afford his life because we need to do the pool trust. Flip it 1 month, and we don't have to do that pool trust for that gentleman.
Right.
And that's incredible. Now, you keep going, and someone has $1,700 a month of income next month. Maybe they decide to do the pool trust. Maybe they just deal with the spend down because they're pretty close to the number. But now that it's the same, equation for maybe you got $2,000 a month. Well, do a pool trust to save $500.
That's worth it. Yeah, it definitely is. And but if you look nationwide, I think I haven't looked this up in a while, but I think something like the average Social Security check in this country, I think, is like $1,500 a month. That's pretty average. Which means that probably half the people get more, and half the people get $1,500 or less.
Yeah.
And so they'd fall into this category. And then when we look at the asset level currently in New York is $16,800. Well, 15 years ago, remember it was like 44 grand or six grand? It was very, very low.
Yeah.
It was adjusted. Now it's going up next year to at least $28,000.
Unbelievable.
Which means a widow who is living on $1,500 of Social Security a month and has $25,000 of savings in her bank account is eligible for home care.
Exactly. And so, for home care, the because it's so easy to qualify, there's no look back currently, keyword currently, you know, we just move money around and you qualify. But the idea that you can have more money in your at your fingertips if you're a mom in that fact pattern, you don't have to worry about, well, how do I pull money out of a trust and could I partially revoke it? Is it what does irrevocable mean? When it comes to that income, you know, that $950-odd you could have now, there's no rules for how you spend it, Harry.
Right.
For the 1563, there's no rules on how you spend that. So a lot of times we have people getting home care. Medicaid will provide 7 hours a day of care. Great. We'll take it. Right? Why not?
Right.
Family says, well, you know what? My dad really needs 13 hours a day of care for us to be comfortable. So you could private pay for 6 hours of care out of that 1500, out of that, you know, whatever amount. You have some great caregivers. They don't want to get paid $15 an hour. They want $25 an hour. You could have Medicaid pay for their 7 hours, and you could separately contract with them for additional hours. Or you just give them more money because it's your money. Right. You could do that with your own money when there's no rules. So it gives you more flexibility. Anytime the government says you're allowed to have more money, that's a good thing. Flat
absolutely.
Out, right?
And the other thing you ought to keep in mind is the $16,000, the $28,000 resource allowance is not just for people on home care.
Right.
That will also be the asset level for someone who is in a nursing home, even if they only get $50 a month of income from their pension and Social Security. They can have $28,000 in a bank account and still go on Social Security.
Yeah.
And then the community spouse still has a $74,000, somewhere between $74,000 and like $130,000.
Yeah, I think it's like $76,000, yeah.
70, whatever it is. So if you add those together, it's a little over $100,000 for a married couple, plus you can prepay your funeral expenses if you haven't already done that. And keep this in mind, those of you out there who have family members who are already in nursing homes or in home care, in January next year, you're going to be able to bring their asset level up from $16,000 by another $12,000 to $28,000. You'll be able to fund their, you know, their asset account and bring it up to the current levels.
Yeah, absolutely. A little more room for error for everybody. And another real common fact pattern, Harry, where I know we've done these for Medicaids all the time. An existing client, they have a Medicaid trust. They met with Harry 10 years ago. They made the right decision and they came, you know, they did a trust. They put their house in it. Maybe they put some money in it. What didn't they put in it? Well, they didn't put in maybe $100,000, maybe $60,000, maybe $50,000. What, you know, because that's their own money to use as they please. They don't have to worry about the trust at all. Eventually something happens. All of a sudden that family comes in and says, I think dad finally needs a nursing home here. Mm-hmm. And when we say, well, what does he have? What's not in the trust? Well, about $50,000 is not in the trust.
Right.
That means today that person has $34,000 more than they're allowed to have, but come January 1st, it means they only have $22,000.
Right.
More.
You can offset it by bringing their resource allowance up to the current levels. We haven't had these kind of dramatic increases ever that I know of.
Yeah, this is a big one, and the ramifications on our end are big. It's sometimes it's tough to explain to clients, you know, and people certainly on the radio. Speaking of which, you could be our first caller by calling 518.
Yeah, we forgot to give out the number when I, you know.
I'm sure they're dying to reach in there. Just say the number so we could all call. 518-476-5900. You know, Harry, there's one other change they did, which I would like to try to explain, but we'll probably fail miserably on it. So in New York, there's
maybe I'll help you.
Yeah, in New York, there are different regions.
I think.
Yeah. And what New York does, they come up with these different regional rates, and basically the further south you are, the higher these regional rates are, and the further, you know, the closer you are to the Canadian border, the lower it is. Let's just put it that way.
And Plattsburgh is probably the lowest here.
And what these regional rates serve to do is it's the method by which Medicaid calculates a penalty period if it turns out you did gifts in the last 5 years. They add up all the gifts. They divide by this rate. They come up with a number, which is your penalty.
Right.
The higher the rate goes, and the rates have gone up, which is a good thing, when you divide something by a higher number, the result of that equation is a smaller number. What that means out there, guys, is if I did the math, if you had $100,000 of gifting that Medicaid found in the last 5 years, and they divided it by the old rate, your penalty would be a little more than 8 months, 8.5 months or so, based on the numbers that currently exist. I'm not going to go into the numbers. All you need to know is because of the rate increase in the regional rate, same 100 grand, same person applying for Medicaid a month later, their penalty period will be under 8 months. You're going to save about half a month of private paying, which is $6,000, $7,000, $8,000 of savings just because the methodology for calculating the rate is a little different in favor of the consumers. So that to me is a big deal too, because I know that's a tangible amount of money if someone has a quote unquote crisis plan. If we're trying to make lemonade out of lemons, I know we can make a little more lemonade.
Right. And the blended rate, the rates that they are they're supposed to represent the average cost of a nursing home in that particular geographic area.
We brought this up last week, and we did this little example, which is, all right, the regional rate's just under $13,000.
It's not just under $13,000.
Find me a nursing home in the area.
Anybody
go
know
ahead.
A nursing home or in the Capital District?
Please.
Could go in there for $13,000 a month, because I have a whole bunch of clients who have relatives who they'd like to move into that nursing home.
Now, the idea of this whole, you know, the whole idea is that you're private paying for what you should have been private paying. At least that's what Medicaid's going to say.
Right.
But if you're private paying more than the rate that they're using, well, then it's a punitive penalty. You are not just dinged for the 100 grand you gave away. You're probably dinged for 120 grand worth of
Well, the thing is, and we point this out to people when they apply for Medicaid, if someone has made a transfer, let's say they transferred $100,000 to one of their children or some of their children, and now they have a nursing home penalty of $13,000. It's going to cost them $15,000 a month of private pay to protect that $13,000. So you're underwater in that situation. Now, if it's possible for the kids to return the money, you can undo the penalty. And this is one of the reasons that we advise people to put the money into their trust rather than to transfer it to their kids. The only reason is once the money is spent, it's very hard to get it back. If the money is put into your trust and invested and you need to get it back to undo a penalty, we could do a partial revocation of your trust and possibly save you a few $1,000s rather, you know. I mean, it makes sense.
If you're listening now, you're saying, hey, this all sounds like they were talking about it last week. We were. And we're going to probably talk about it next time we're on the radio as well, because these changes are so important. And the idea of doing a trust as opposed to just, oh, I'll just give money to my kids. There are long-term consequences to that.
It's easier. It's less expensive. But it's fraught with all sorts of pitfalls.
Harry, last week we also talked about, very briefly, about the wonderful actress Kirstie Alley.
Kirstie Alley, yes.
Cheers.
Oh, yeah.
Look who's
talking. Yeah, I'm kidding. I never missed Cheers.
Weight Watchers. I remember from everything. You know.
Oh, she had tremendous difficulty with weight.
She became an amazing spokesman for that because everyone saw, oh, my God, she's on the cover of People magazine. She lost, you know, 60 pounds. Anyway, a little more intel about Kirstie. We weren't sure what exactly she had and where it's going.
She wasn't that old.
71, I think.
Yeah, it was 71, yeah. That's right.
Think that's old.
I'm with you, Harry.
A quick bout of cancer for her, unfortunately.
Oh, that's what
it is. Yeah, very impressive.
Right, yeah. Okay, yeah.
About $40 million plus properties in multiple states. So she has a place in Kansas. She's got a place in California, a place in Florida. She was building something.
I hope she had a trust with all those real estate in all those different states.
So based on what I read this morning, everything keeps saying her estate is worth this, and this is what her estate says, and this is where things are going to go based on her estate, which in our world, if you are using the word estate, that technically means we're talking about wills and probating and
so on.
Somebody
must have filed something somewhere in a court, which would suggest a probate proceeding is underway.
Right.
Rather than a private secret trust that we don't have to tell everybody how much money is in it.
Right.
Except the IRS, of course, and people like that.
If you read an article talking about how someone gave away their estate so soon after someone's passing, it likely means they just did a will. And you got to have a will, right? Everyone's got to have a will. Yeah, you should have a will, but for most people, and you know, forget an actress and famous actress worth, you know, millions of dollars. She had property in more than one state. Please avoid probate. Please.
Well,
I'm begging you.
You know what that is, because every state in which you own a piece of real estate, you have to initiate a separate probate proceeding to transfer the property pursuant to the will, or just sell it and distribute the money to the beneficiaries in the will. I mean, it's just, well, I had an estate like that about 15 years ago.
What's that? With multiple ancillary probates?
He was only in his 50s. He didn't take good care of himself. It was a very large estate. But he had real estate in New York, Vermont, I think Mississippi, two other states.
I would not put those states all together, by the way.
He had property in the Maritime Provinces in Canada.
Wow.
And had and I love you will that another lawyer had prepared. We didn't prepare the will.
How many people do you think have a house in Vermont and Mississippi? Probably not a lot.
No one that I know of, other than this particular person.
Well, you know, for Kirsty, she's not only going to deal with probate in multiple states, she might be dealing with estate tax consequences for state estate taxes.
She will,
obviously,
I don't think she was
not
married.
In Florida.
I don't think she was married, was she?
Not anymore.
She used to be married to Parker Stevenson.
Yeah.
He was one of the Hardy Boys way back when in the. You it probably predated you were probably.
Yeah, I think he was in some other stuff later on, post Hardy Boys.
He was. The other guy, I forget who the other Hardy Boy was. It was, it was David Cassidy's brother. He had a younger brother, remember, from the Partridge Family. Did you watch the Partridge Family when you were a kid?
Harry, I was born in 1980.
No, I guess you couldn't.
I guess you didn't watch the Partridge Family.
I didn't watch the Partridge Family.
Shirley Jones, and, I don't know, okay. Another time, another place.
Let's go with memories 1986 and later, and I'm with you for the most part.
Okay, $200.
Reruns.
$400, Alex.
Oh, that's funny.
Okay.
Anyway, if you're out there and you have property in more than one state, it is really, you know, as you're planning your estate, I'm not planning for you going anywhere tomorrow, but eventually you are going to go somewhere. The correct answer usually is going to be to do a trust. If you plan on continuing to own those properties up until when you pass away. A lot of times, Harry, people, their sentiment is, I just want to make things easier for my kids. And what that translates to me is not that you want them to have more money necessarily. It's that you want the process after you pass away to be really easy. I don't want it to be like it was when my mom died. You know, that's what our clients say to us.
Right.
The translation is not the will clearly says what you want to have happen to your assets. That certainly helps, having a good will that clearly says your wishes. That helps, that eases the process. But if we're able to have that same language inside a trust, I don't have to ask, you know, Saratoga County Surrogates Court whether or not I've provided enough evidence for them to say that, you know, mom's will is in fact her last will and testament. Mm-hmm. That process, and then their supervision on it, and then the filing fees on it, and then what happens if I can't serve somebody with a document the court wants me to serve, those ramifications make, you know, some estates incredibly expensive. We have an estate that is barely past the small estate level, Harry, which is about $50,000.
Right.
And the I would imagine the collective legal fees between all the attorneys involved for this estate that has less around $50,000. Yeah. It's probably about $14,000 worth of legal fees.
It's ridiculous.
Cutting back some. And it's because when there's a fight, there's a fight. And the procedural parts of that fight are not dependent on the value of the estate. Whether it's worth fighting is a different issue, which we're trying to parse through.
Oh, exactly. Yeah. You know, I always say, you know, in a will contest, the only people who win are the lawyers, you know, invariably. But you can, if you get it set up, and you have, here's the thing. Every state is different, you know. So if you have a house in New York, we can handle that. We don't practice law in Vermont, all right? So you have to hire a Vermont lawyer to do an ancillary probate proceeding to deal with your house there, or a New Jersey lawyer, or if you have a house in Arizona or something like that. Each laws of probate, they're very similar, but they're all different.
Now, where the opposite is true, though, is if you're a client who has a Vermont house and has a New York house and has a Florida or a Mississippi house. You, Harry, as a New York attorney, can create a New York trust. We can arrange for those properties to be transferred to your one New York trust.
That's the great thing about it, because you can put all those properties into one single trust. You don't need a separate trust for each house. Okay. And you can, I've had clients over the last couple of years. I had a client within the last 5 years. Her main house, she used to live here. She moved to Arizona. She kept a house here in New York State for the summer. She would come back in the summer, and because she had family that lived in the area. Her Arizona house and her New York house were all in her New York revocable trust. Okay?
Perfect.
Medicaid was not an issue for this person. Probate avoidance was. And guess what? When she passed away, we wrapped up her estate, which was fairly large, in, I would say, about 6 or 7 months,
yeah,
which was remarkable. I mean,
and that's just logistics of who gets what and selling properties if there's to be sold.
Valuing assets, there was, the usual issues, and nobody was fighting with each other over mom's estate. So, it went very smoothly. But if we had had to probate her will in New York and they go hire a law firm out in Phoenix to do an ancillary probate proceeding out there, it complicates. People want it simple. Keep it simple.
You'd still have those, you said a relatively complicated estate took several months, 6-7 months, just in terms of who gets what and are we selling this property? No. My brother wants that property and, maybe equalizing, it gets complicated. The probate part is before you even get to that part, which is who's got the authority to sign for the estate? Who's got the authority to sell that Phoenix house? Who's
Nobody.
Got the authority? Right. So you got to go through the probate. And usually, if you're a New York resident, and we'll start, we'll stop talking about this and get to something else eventually here. But if you are a resident of New York, most other states will say, no. First, you need to become authorized under the will in New York, under the New York probate.
Right.
And then will you be able to have the standing to do the ancillary probate in Arizona.
Yeah, because you have to file an exemplified or certified copy of the will, the original will. Yes.
Well, more on something else right after the break. We'll see you on the other half hour for the Herzog Law Firm's Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour right after this.
You've been listening to the Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour with the Herzog Law Firm. Join us every week to learn more about protecting the assets you've worked hard for, options available for Medicaid planning, and more. With offices located in Corporate Woods in Albany, West Harrison Street in Saratoga Springs, Executive Woods in Clifton Park, and 130 North Front Street in Kingston, our attorneys are here to help you. If you'd like to schedule an appointment to speak with David, Jane Marie, or Harry, please call us during normal business hours, Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. To contact us at our Albany office, call 518-465-7581. Our Saratoga Springs office, 518-581-8131. Our Clifton Park office at 518-952-4010. And our Kingston office at 845-338-6405. Let the Herzog Law Firm help navigate a plan that works for you and your family. Now back to the Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour with the Herzog Law Firm.
And welcome back. I'm Harry Miller.
Good morning. I'm Dave Kubikin.
And we are commencing the second half hour of the Herzog Law Firm's Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour, brought to you right here at Magic 590. And we would love to talk to you this morning on this snowy, slushy December, 17th?
17th.
Yeah. Something like that. The number here in the studio is 518-476-5900. That's 518-476-5900. And we've been chatting first half hour about a lot of the increases in Medicaid income and asset limits and home care and the importance of the importance and the relative ease of administration of passing your assets through a trust rather than having them go through a probate proceeding, which is a court-supervised distribution of your assets, which in many instances is a good thing to avoid.
By the way, I just want to say, thanks to the weather forecast, yesterday, we closed the office a little early. I went home grabbed the kids, we went to the mall. I got a parking space, like, three spaces from the store, from Barnes & Noble. Because nobody was there.
I might have been there. I was there.
I walked around. Nobody was anywhere.
The ghost town.
It was amazing. Do your Christmas shopping during
a storm.
During storms that don't happen that much.
Eight days before Christmas. The mall is a ghost
nobody
town.
Nobody was there.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah, I got a lot done. So thank you to
Mother Nature.
Mother Nature.
Whoever did the... All right, so Harry, I got a story for you here. Ripped from the headlines, 100% true. It's an estate matter. And we did the trust for this client a long time ago.
Uh-huh.
And the trust said, I give everything to my two kids. That was one section. And then there another section said, I would like to equalize and take into account those things I gave to my two kids during their lives for purposes of equalizing these other things.
Right. Other assets distributed otherwise, like joint bank accounts.
Correct. Yeah. Right. So the purpose of this gentleman's trust was to treat his two kids equally, as equal as humanly possible, to the point where we're going to look at assets outside of the trust for purposes of determining equalization. Okay?
Yes.
This gentleman goes to another firm years later, 10 years later, for changing his trust. And the type of trust he had, because he did it so long ago, allowed him to amend his trust through his will.
Okay.
So it's called a power of appointment that he had, and he exercised that power to change the rules of his trust. And he did it to change the who gets what part of his trust.
Yes.
So we had done a will when we had done the trust. So some other attorney out there, no names, did a codicil to a will. A codicil is like an amendment to a will. We at Herzog Law Firm do not do codicils. We do new wills. And the reason why is because if you do a codicil to the will, an amendment, that whole probate process involves us probating the will and proving all those very same things for the codicil as well. It's double the work. We have to find, we have to make sure both originals are going to go through the probate process successfully.
It also republishes the will as of the date of the codicil. It could create other problems.
Correct. So what the codicil tried to do was to amend the trust, right, using this power of appointment. I'm going to change the terms of my trust. And it said this property goes to him, this property goes to her, and the rest of my documents are the same. The rest of my trust is the same. Okay? However, the other section of the trusts actually should have been amended as well, because the equalization language was meant for non-real estate. And all of a sudden, I had a situation where one person's getting a larger valued property compared to the other person.
Yes.
And arguably, the equalization provision might not apply to real estate.
At least it created an ambiguity.
An ambiguity, yes. Thank you. Because I think when push came to shove, the intent of the client would have been reflected and so on and so forth. And it was just a really poorly done codicil. Even if it wasn't a codicil and it was a new will, it based on that, it didn't amend enough of the trust. You don't just put it's like if you're repainting your home, Harry, you're not just going to, get this little section of the wall. You're going to notice that it doesn't fit with the rest of the wall.
We need to paint the whole wall.
You got to paint the whole wall.
Not just the part that's scuffed.
Yes. But it created this ambiguity. And that resulted in, another attorney being involved in the administration of this gentleman's estate. And these two siblings who do not get along.
So they're fighting with each other.
Fighting with each other. And about, wait a minute. I got the more expensive house. But I also get more money than you because of other things that happened previous in life. And we're saying, wait a minute. You got the higher valued property, and your father's goal was to equalize everything, clearly. But the problem is it wasn't clearly that anymore because the codicil made it ambiguous.
Unclear.
So, Harry, it happens. So number one, if you use Harry Miller for your will and then eventually for your trust, can you go to another attorney? Of course you can, right? That you are entirely allowed to do whatever you want with your file and your estate plan, all that stuff. However, don't do it for purposes of trying to save a buck because someone's going to do a quick little something for you. It's really important that you maintain that level of consistency if you can. Even to the point where if we're not your attorney, maybe you continue to use the attorney you have if they're doing a good job, right? This is not an advertisement for Herzog. However, the words matter, and the words in the whole document matter. You can't just patch up a little piece of the document without looking at the rest of the document. And typically when, you know, it's Harry Miller that did your trust, Harry Miller knows every inch of that trust. So he'll know everything that's going to need to change, even when you had that little patch that you need to do.
Even if you don't. I mean, especially, I mean, for me, to me, the utilization of a codicil at all, and especially in those circumstances, is just poor.
It's lazy.
It's lazy. It's poor. You know, people, and just what David said, people come and say, oh, I just want to do a codicil to my will. I said, no, we're going to do a whole new will. And by the way, it's going to cost you the same. If I do a codicil or I do a new will, the fee is exactly the same. So it's not like you're saving any money. And codicils create problems. In this situation, just to do a new, particularly if you're not the lawyer who did the trust and things like that, I say, let's do a whole new will, which completely revokes the prior one. And inside of that will, we will exercise the changes I want in my trust, and then we'll restate my old will the same way it was before, or however I'm going to change it. And the first paragraph of your will says, I hereby revoke all of my prior wills.
Yep.
The first paragraph of the codicil doesn't say that. It says I'm amending my old will. My old will's still the same. It's still my old will, except as I've changed it by this new document. And then when the new document isn't clear, well, guess what you have? You have a will contest. You have a construction proceeding in front of the judge to construe what the person who died. The controlling thing is what the court's trying to do is divine what was the testator's intention.
Yeah.
That's supposed to control. But when it's been muddied up through poor drafting, you just have a whole mess.
And I'll tell you, Harry, in the file, and it was not your file. It was another attorney that used to be at the firm long ago. I think it was Sholem. There were notes. No, this is the intent. There was a memo in the file. This is what the client wanted.
Simultaneous notes during the conference with the client as to the client. This is what the client's intent is.
Correct.
If we're trying to interpret what the will says.
Right.
Yeah.
The quickie codicil didn't come with notes. It didn't say, well, this is the difference in who's getting this property and that property. However, he still wants to equalize everything. Right. Those notes would have helped one way or another. It's very clear, you know, these assets were in the trust before. All of a sudden, he's deciding who's going to get what between these properties. Why wouldn't everything continue to be equalized? Uh-huh. Especially based on the notes that our firm had on it. But it's unfortunate because it leads to these fights, these ambiguities. And when you don't get along with someone, if you're contentious, you might get. Look, if I'm playing a sport against you, Harry, and I see a weakness in the way you're playing, I could exploit that weakness to my benefit. And if I'm a bully and you're my sibling and I want to bully you, I'm going to take advantage of every little way I can. And, you know, our documents aren't supposed to patch the emotional aspects to your kids' relationship.
You want to force me to use my backhand in pickleball?
I will focus on your...
My forehand's better than my backhand.
Okay, well, then I'm going to write that down. So do you play pickleball, by the way?
I have. It's a hot sport.
Do you like
North Carolina?
It's everywhere.
It's the hottest new sport
John,
in America.
Have you ever heard of this pickleball?
Oh, yeah. It's very popular, especially if you live in Florida.
It's all people can do besides play golf. Well, it's a lot cheaper.
Listen, I'm not going there with the old...
Well, it's a big senior activity. It's true.
Seems like
and getting very popular with the younger people, too, now.
Oh, that's what I was going to say. This is not a senior thing.
Not anymore.
No, not anymore. That's right.
It started out as something seniors particularly did, you know, for recreational fun.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's caught fire across the country. It's amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, unfortunate name for marketing purposes, I think. I think it seems childish. I remember playing pickleball in school. I won't tell you what decade that
was. It's like a wiffle ball. They say like a wiffle ball and a paddle. Yeah. That's a little better than a ping pong paddle. It's smaller than a tennis racket.
Very nice.
You know.
So is that
then that's lower.
When you're in Carolina, are you doing a lot of pickleball?
Well, we haven't been down there. We don't spend enough time down there now. But there are definitely, I mean, my next door neighbors, they play pickleball twice a week. Okay,
uh-huh.
There's a mixed couples league, and then there's a men's league, and a women's, so they play in the mixed league, and then these play in a men's and women's, and they, it's just, you know,
it's great. Good exercise.
He's a little competitive, but mostly they do it for fun.
And now they know if they listen or they listen to the podcast, they just focus on Harry Miller's backhand and they'll win every match.
There you go. There you go.
I think we do have our first caller here, Harry. We do. It's John in Clifton Park. Good morning, John. How are you?
Oh, I'm excellent. How are you this morning?
Can't complain.
We're good.
What's going on?
Okay. I got a couple questions for you. I'm one of your clients. And my first question's about doing a conversion from a standard IRA to a Roth. In my current situation, the only reason I'm considering that is my current Roth is in required distribution because of my age, and the sums, I'm 85 years old, and the sums are fairly large coming out of that. They're putting me in a different tax bracket. And I was considering converting to a Roth, but I understand that the 5-year look back period kicks in if I do that. Is that correct?
Well,
you mean for Medicaid?
Yeah. So the IRA is special. It's not a resource. You know, when Harry was talking earlier in the hour about $16,800 going to $28,133, which is the actual.
Yes.
He wasn't talking about your IRAs, right? He was talking about your other resources. So Medicaid, remember, looks at the IRA as a potential stream of income down the road, not as a pile of money that you have direct access to.
Okay.
Now, Roths are tricky, right? So if you had a Roth IRA and you're applying for Medicaid, you're going to have some decisions to make. And my question to you would be, you know, and this is also for you to talk to with your financial advisor, what's the plan long term? Because, you know, you turn something to a Roth, everyone always focuses on the tax-free growth that the Roth IRA has, whereas we're always concerned not with the growth of your money, but protecting the money in case we have a long-term care need, because it doesn't matter that it grew tax-free if we're about to lose a big pile of it. So,
right.
You know, I wouldn't look at the Medicaid aspect as a big part of whether you convert or not. I think there's got to be other reasons and financial reasons and tax reasons that you would do
right.
So. And that's where I'd
right.
rely on your financial advisor and your accountant.
Your tax people have to, because yeah. You know, if you convert it, you're going to pay the tax at that point.
Right. And I'm well aware.
And only for
I'm
the future tax free growth. Yeah.
Right. For future tax free growth. But the difference between the regular IRA and the Roth for Medicaid purposes, both of them are not considered countable resources that have to be spent down. They're rather streams of income. Now, you currently have to take RMDs out of your regular IRA, and you got to take it out before the end of this year. For those of you who haven't taken out your RMD, you got to do it by December 31st, unless it's your first one, which you can defer till April. But your Roth IRA does not have any RMDs. However, the kicker is, if you applied for Medicaid, if you're not taking RMDs from the Roth, then it's a countable resource. All right? So if you went into a nursing home or you got home care at home, you'd have to start putting your Roth into distribution status, which would have the same RMDs as your regular one does, in order for it to not count as an asset for Medicaid eligibility purposes. So I don't think it gets you. I don't think it gets you anywhere. I don't think the 5-year look back would apply to that. I'm not aware of that, but in order to have it disregarded as an asset, you're going to have to convert it to the same income stream you're receiving now.
Okay, so yeah, I'm receiving RMDs out of my regular, and the only reason I'm really considering it was because of the current status of the stock market. My Roth IRA or my IRA is not doesn't have the value that it had a year ago.
Neither does anybody else's.
Right.
Really.
Right. So So paying the taxes on it would, you know, obviously be beneficial at this point in time.
Well, yeah, because it's a lower amount of money. I understand, yeah.
Right. Now, but, John,
so if my RMDs are going to be part of it in the nursing home issue. They're going to be required to be paid to the nursing home anyway, correct?
Your RMDs are income. And so it depends on what your income is from the RMDs, your social, and if you have a spouse, what her income is from pension, Social Security. So, yeah, some or all of the RMD could very well go to your nursing home.
Well, so John,
no, my only big benefit would be that I'm not having to take the distributions out of the Roth IRA, I guess.
As long as you're not on Medicaid, that's correct. If you never go on Medicaid, you can just defer that out.
It wouldn't be putting me in the tax bracket situation that I'm in now.
Well, John, the other benefit is if you're saying, well, you know what, you know, markets that go down go back up eventually, and you
had the tax hit
from the IRA, and you then fund a Roth that is going to grow tax-free, then maybe on the growth side of the stock market, you're doing pretty good there. What I would caution you on is when you turn something that's an IRA. And by the way, the RMD is just the beginning for what Medicaid wants. They actually want you to maximize your distribution, and the RMD has the word minimum in there, so it's not maximizing. The percentage they actually want is a relatively low percentage. So we view the retirement rules as actually a pretty good thing for our clients, because in other years, not 2022, the market may grow 6% in a year when they want your 6% distribution. So it may be that the family didn't exactly lose money from that income rule. When you when you take something that's like an IRA and you have the tax hit and now it's a resource of yours, even for a little bit, you just remove that quote unquote protected status. It's now like cash, and that's when 5-year look back periods will start to apply. Not because the transfer to cash happened to the 5 years, but because you have the cash now.
Yes.
So sometimes, from a planning standpoint, when I have clients who have a Roth, I'll say to them, hey, look, I'd like you to weigh the tax-free future growth of this Roth IRA and, you know, instead maybe liquidating it, no taxes because it's a Roth, and putting the proceeds into a trust to hopefully get through 5 years. And it's not as simple as that. You know, we look at how your health is and all that stuff to see whether it makes sense or not. But the idea is protecting the resources so we don't have to do that, you know, crisis plan Harry was talking about in the first half hour.
Yeah. I have a Medicaid trust with you. So.
Yeah. So you should, you know, it's a longer conversation. I think it's one that should involve your accountant and your financial advisor. We'd love to, you know, check back in with us in the office as well, obviously.
Yeah. Okay. All right.
Great.
I have one other hopefully short question, if I could.
Sure.
And that relates to using HERS-STRPES as a beneficiary designation.
Right. Okay. And what's
is that a good? Well, here's a problem I'm having. A friend of mine just recently told me that he discovered through this DNA testing that's going on, everybody's doing, that he now has a sibling that used to be his next door neighbor.
Dun dun dun.
Really? Okay.
Wow. Okay. Well, so
apparently there was his father had a dalliance with a neighbor.
Oh my gosh! 23andMe discovered.
John, it's too early in the morning for something so scandalous. This is
That's interesting. So, HERS-STRPES wouldn't apply to siblings, first of all, John. HERS-STRPES is lineal descendants, okay? So your sister or your brother is not a HERS-STRPES beneficiary. If you have two children and you name your two kids as beneficiaries on your account and you check the box that says HERS-STRPES, and not all companies allow you to do that. All right. Some of these things, you got to read the fine print. Some of these things say, we'll pay it to those two kids or whichever of them is alive when you die. So if you die and one of your kids predeceases you, you could inadvertently cut out the children of that deceased child, your grandchildren.
The idea, okay. John, of the purse strippers.
So it doesn't fall to the grandchildren.
It might.
Of the deceased.
Well, so John, here's how it works. Just picture a tree, right? A family tree or a real tree with tree branches. So when you leave things to your issue, to your children or, you know, your blood, your lineal descendants, like Harry mentioned, and you do it per stirpes, we are treating each tree branch separately. We're maintaining that branch if possible. So if you have three kids, three branches, each branch gets a third. If one of those children predeceases you, right, so a leaf falls off that branch, we keep going down that branch, that very same branch, to see if there's other leaves, his children. Okay, so if that child that predeceased you had a couple kids, your grandkids, those grandkids would split their dad's one-third interest in your estate.
Correct.
Per stirpes is one way to do it. Another way to do it is called by representation. And what that does is it treats all of the same level the same. So if you had one kid that predeceased you and they had one child, and you had another child who predeceased you who had three kids, if you did representation, all those grandkids get the same amount. When you do it per stirpes, the branches are maintained.
Right.
And so the one who's got one kid, that grandchild happens to get a third of the pie, whereas the other grandkids would get less than a third because they are sharing their dad's share.
They got to split their portion. Okay.
Right.
It rewards the children who have more kids. Penalizes the ones who have fewer kids.
Yeah, okay.
Which, and you can do it either way. You can do it either way. In fact, the presumption in New York now is by representation. Years ago, it was per stirpes, but it's not anymore. But the other thing could happen, you got to watch this, is if the per stirpital kids, if the grandkids are minors, okay, we may want to look at something else rather than beneficiary designations, because they have limits on them. In any event, it wouldn't go to that person's sister or brother who lived next door and was recently discovered.
Okay.
So it's only down the line of children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren, and the like. Okay?
Okay.
Thanks, John.
But this neighbor in the situation, if there was a will, would have some kind of an issue as far as contesting it?
Well, no. I see. So we discovered this this sibling that used to be here, and I got it. Okay. And so that person, the sibling would only have some standing to object to the will if the guy had no spouse and no children, okay, and no parents.
Okay.
All right. So if the brother either had a spouse or children who survived him, then the sibling would not receive any portion of the inheritance. All right. Because here's the deal, and this is another reason to have a trust rather than passing your property through a will. When a person dies and has a will that's going to transfer their property through a probate proceeding, you have to notify everyone who would inherit their estate if they didn't have a will, okay?
Correct.
And the problem is, a lot of time, those people aren't in the will, so they're not particularly cooperative, and they might not be particularly happy if they're getting cut out of the estate. So, but believe me, they'll show up. They'll show up and they'll make trouble if they can. So, but if he survived by a spouse and some children, you don't need to worry about the sister. All right.
Okay. Yeah. I don't want to belabor it. I don't want to take up all your time.
That's okay.
I think I understand. Okay.
So I wouldn't worry about
it. Thank you very much.
Thanks, John. Thanks for listening. The thing about it is that having a trust eliminates a lot of having to find these people who aren't going to receive any of your money anyway, but they have the ability to really make a mess of your estate if they choose to.
Yeah, so, all right. Okay. Yes, thank you.
All right.
Yep.
Have a nice holiday.
Good holiday,
right.
Thank you.
What we got, John? We got, what, Christmas? A week from tomorrow is Christmas. Tomorrow,
I can't believe it. I mean,
tomorrow night's the first night of Hanukkah.
Right.
That goes on for, you know, that's 8 days, you know. And then I don't know when Kwanzaa is this year. Maybe is that usually around this time?
I'm not quite sure myself. I think it started earlier, but I'm not sure. Don't count on me to know that. I should, but I don't.
Well, I don't know. I don't have my cell phone with me. So anyway.
And, yeah, I didn't bring my information here.
We were talking about codicils. And,
yeah.
You know, and I do want to remember, because we were talking about RMDs with John earlier.
Yeah.
And, you know, most of you who have your IRAs set up in investment accounts, you know, your investment firm or your broker or your financial advisor, they just automatically tell you what your RMD is, and they probably push it out. You know, some people take it monthly, some people take it quarterly, but you have to take it annually, and, you know, you only got about, you know, 2 weeks left to do that by the end of the year. So if for some reason you have forgotten to take it, and then again, as John says, this is just out of your regular IRA. You do not have to take a distribution out of your Roth IRA. You can, but you're not required to under the tax laws. If you don't take out your regular distribution from your regular IRA, then there are significant penalties. You know, there's a 50% penalty on what the RMD was, and you have to pay income tax on the whole money that you didn't take out. So, you know, if you're in a 25% tax bracket, you could wind up being penalized to about 75% of what you should have taken out. So it's a big deal to make sure that those get distributed out properly, because the consequences of that are pretty gosh darn significant. Don't forget, also, if you're writing checks, this is the holiday time. Everybody is gift-giving, okay?
Right.
So this year, for those of you who are not aware of it, the annual exclusion amount for gift-giving is $16,000. So you can write a check to each of your kids for up to that amount, and if you're married, so can your spouse. So.
All right. Well, by the way, Harry, Kwanzaa is December 26th. I found that.
Oh, day after. Okay,
there we go.
Fine.
Yeah.
Thanks, John. Okay. We'll talk to you all next week.
Thank you for listening to the Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour with the Herzog Law Firm. For more information on their services, please visit HerzogLaw.com. If you'd like to speak with one of their attorneys, please contact the Albany office at 518-465-7581, the Saratoga office at 518-581-8131, or their Kingston office at 845-338-6405.